Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Denny Griffin here, and for the next hour, I'll be your host for a special program about sexual crimes against children, and specifically the Hannah Mack case and the broader problem of sexual exploitation of children in general. And before I begin, I'd like to say hello to my special friends at Juror 13 and also at Justice Interrupted. I'm going to have two guests with me tonight. The first guest I'll introduce is Heather Steele. And Heather is the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Innocent Justice Foundation, which supports law enforcement efforts to investigate and prosecute child pornography crimes. My other guest, joining us shortly, I hope, will be Robin Sachs. Robin is an L.A. County Deputy District Attorney who specializes in prosecuting sex crimes against children. For over 15 years, she has prosecuted some of the most despicable defendants who have committed the most heinous crimes. For the last 7 years, she's been the prosecuting attorney for the Child Sexual Assault Division of the L.A. County Sex Crimes Unit, and in that capacity, she works with multidisciplinary team at UCLA's Rape Treatment Center, the Stewart House, along with law enforcement, victims, advocates, social workers, members of the L.A. Department of Children and Family Services. She conducts forensic interviews of child victims of sexual abuse, structures investigation plans to maximize the chances of successfully prosecuting their abusers, and handles all aspects of the subsequent prosecutions. And I think one of my guests has just joined us. Hold on, please. Hello.
Hi, Denny, it's Heather.
Heather, welcome back.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here tonight with you.
Okay, Robin isn't with us yet, but before I begin, I want to hold on. I think we got another call. It might be Robin now.
It is. It's me.
Hi, Robin.
Hi there. How are you? Sorry about that.
No problem. Thanks for joining. Thanks for joining us. I just read your bios, the listeners. And before I get started, I'm really hung up on this Hannah Mack case. And
yes.
For people not familiar with that, I want to read a couple of excerpts from the newspaper article about Hannah Mack. And let me start. This is from February 14th of 2009 from the Corsicana Daily Sun, and excerpts of the article written by Janet Jacobs. On Friday, February 13th, Sean Earl Arender, 22-year-old small-time thief who had spent more time in jail than out of it, confessed to the sexual assault and murder of 6-year-old Hannah Mack near Navarro Mills in the fall of 2007. Arender gave his confession in open court as part of a plea bargain to avoid the death penalty. He was sentenced to life in prison without possibility of parole by District Judge James Lagomasarino. Under questioning by District Attorney R. Lowell Thompson, Arender testified that he and Kevin Wayne Anders, the live-in boyfriend of Dana Mack, Hannah's mother, smoked marijuana and talked about sex, then took the girl into the garage next to the house where she was choked into submission, sexually assaulted, and then hung from the rafters. Arender was arrested 2 days after the murder on a burglary and possession charge, and it was while he was in jail that DNA evidence found on the small victim was linked to his DNA pattern in the state database. Since then, Arender has been kept in solitary confinement in county jail under suicide watch. He tried to commit suicide at least 3 times. On the stand, he unraveled a sickening tale of people on the edge of society and the consequences for the vulnerable children in their midst. Arender said that on September 9, 2007, he and his pregnant girlfriend, some friends, went swimming at Navarro Mills and then drove into Corsicana to buy drugs. After returning to the trailer where Arender lived with his aunt, he had sex with his girlfriend, then went outside to smoke marijuana. As he smoked, he walked down the street about 2 blocks and ran into Kevin Wayne Anders outside the house where Anders lived with Dana Mack and her 3 daughters. At 6, Hannah was the youngest. Anders recognized him, Arender said, and called him over. They'd first met in 2005 while both were in the county jail. They sat on the front porch and smoked pot and talked. At first they talked about anything and then about sex. Anders allegedly asked Arinder if he wanted to make pornography or to star in videos. Anders then brought up the fact that he lived with three stepdaughters and they were, quote, cute, unquote. It was just a conversation, lasted about 2 hours, I guess, Arinder said. We talked about me being in prison, what kinds of things happened in prison. We talked a lot about sex. After more talk and drugs, Anders went into the house and brought Hannah out. Arinder said that while they were sitting there, Anders mumbled something to the girl who said no, and then he mumbled something else, and she said it hurts. And when he turned around, Anders had his hands in Hannah's pants, and the girl screamed. She screamed or made a loud noise, and Kevin reached up and grabbed her by the throat and jumped up and told me to come on before somebody sees us, and we went over to the garage. Arinder said Anders choked Hannah into unconsciousness, then put her on the couch and urged Arinder to have sex with the girl while he watched. Arinder said that both of them molested the girl before she began struggling again and tried to scream. Anders silenced by choking her and then using a rope. Hannah's body was hung from the rafters. So I guess my question to both of you, let me start with you, Heather. Do I have a right to be ticked off?
I'm finding it hard to control myself even as we speak. It's unbelievable what they do to these kids, and it just defies belief. You can't believe that not only would one of them, but he just finds another one on the street who would participate in this. It's very difficult to hear and listen to and believe, but it really happens.
And you
every day, all over America.
This is not isolated. I mean, this is the extreme, I suppose, but it's this, as you said, this stuff goes on apparently all the time. I wasn't aware of it, and I got to tell you, my blood is boiling. Robin, what are your thoughts on this this particular case, and then we'll get into the general overall problem.
Well, I echo Heather's thoughts and yours in terms of the disgust and the repulsiveness, and I do think that this is an example of an extreme example of child abuse and sexual assault, and you know, as heinous and sickening as this case is, the problem in my mind with this case, in terms of looking at it as an example of what goes on in society, is that there is so much that doesn't have this kind of level of, you know, complete lack of conscience, lack of, you know, disregard for human life, disregard for, a child, where you see all the time that there's justifications because it's not as extreme, where there's touching and child sexual assault that, you know, doesn't feel as heinous in terms of the perpetrator, but they justify it because it's not as, you know, heinous as this type of crime. So I think we have to be careful in terms of characterizing what happens every day, because I don't want the general community to feel like it's only, you know, a crime if it's this extreme.
Okay, we're going to be taking calls with your questions or comments in just a minute. The number you can reach us at is 646-478-0982. 646-478-0982, and we have a caller on the line already, and I'll be answering that in just a second. But I wanted to make a couple of other points before we go to the phone. I did a little research on the county that this took place in, Navarro County in Texas, and the population last census I could find was right around 50,000, so that's not a densely populated area, I would suppose, in the great scheme of things. It's not too awful far from Dallas. And I don't know, I was always naive, I suppose, under the impression that rural areas or the more sparsely populated, you wouldn't find any abusers or molesters in those areas. And, you know, they were all in the big cities and so forth. And I also was under apparent misimpression that only the molesters are almost exclusively poorly educated, always in trouble types, you know, that you could pick them out on the street. If you saw them, you'd say, hey, that guy looks like a molester. But that's not true either, as Heather educated me last time we were on a program. So apparently these people are out there, and you don't necessarily tell just by looking at them. Am I right, Heather, on that?
Well, Denny, what I really want to point out in this case is that you mentioned that both of these men were with adult women in relationships. And actually, the one had sex with his girlfriend right before he started walking down the street. So what I'd like to say about that is that these people are often in relationships and married. And I think it's really key to point that out, is that people think, oh, they're only, they could only have sex with children. And if someone's in a relationship, we automatically rule him out. But it's part of their predatory instinct, or what they do, or their job as predators, to seek out opportunities where they can be with single moms, or they may, be breeding their own children to molest. So there are lots of situations where you're going to find these guys who are married and with girlfriends.
I mean, if I can just interject here, I think that the key of what you're saying and what you're both saying is that there isn't a typical profile of what a predator is from the outside. The characteristics can be, married or not married. It can be someone with a criminal record or someone with no criminal record. It can be someone in a rural area or an urban area. The idea is these are people who put themselves in situations where they have access to children, so that they can then groom them to then, prey on them.
Let me, ladies, just stop here and take our first caller. Hello, could you tell us your name, please, and where you're calling from?
Yes, my name is Angel, and I'm calling from the state of Idaho.
Okay, go ahead with your question or comment, please.
Actually, there's a comment. I founded the nonprofit organization Angels Against Child Predators, and what I'm doing is providing a legally required solution for law enforcement to stop the advertising of child pornography on the internet. Child predators have become so aggressive, they actually are placing it in pop-up ads and, just shoving it, in layman terms, all over everyone's computer, and it's highly prolific. Currently, we have over 30 million community members in support, more than 50 law enforcement agencies, and we have two state senators that are endorsing this legally required solution. We need to protect mass population from false charges of possession of child pornography, because again, pop-up ads are forced onto a computer system. Anyone utilizing their ISP blockers, it blocks the material, they don't see it, but the child pornography is still on their hard drive. And as of this past year in 2008, there were over 200,000 individuals that were arrested, have been charged, they're sitting in jail for possession of child pornography, but computer technology, the analysis rendered it was in pop-up ads. They did not download it. They were not viewing it. There's no history of soliciting it. And that type of conduct has got to stop. There's laws in place. The FBI, for whatever reason, is not moving on it. But what is happening is that these perpetrators of such heinous crimes have easy access to horrid websites that are located here in the United States, easily verifiable. The Internet Watch Foundation put out their news broadcast in 2006 with their studies and research. 50% of the world's child pornography is coming from the United States. Fact, not fiction. So I don't want to sound like I'm hacking on the FBI, but we have to become more aggressive. I've provided a solution that is at no financial cost. In the interim, we, the community, must take more aggressive measures to seek finances for law enforcement.
Okay, can you hold on just a second, please? I'd like to give Heather and Robin a chance to comment or respond back if they would like to.
Sure.
Yeah, I think I would be ecstatic if 200,000 people were arrested for child pornography. I think that we're doing nationwide about 6,000 a year. That's according to our law enforcement statistics.
No, these statistics I gleaned from law enforcement. Nationwide, over 200,000 were convicted. This is through the FBI as well as just the Sheriff's Department. But go ahead. Matter of fact, even in 2005, one local office of Maitland, Florida, just one office, 4,500, they convicted in 2005. So I'm sorry to say your statistics are extremely extremely wrong. And it is startling that so many people are being charged and they are finding out it's in pop-up ads. That was addressed to Congress in 2003.
My comment is that, and I, you know, as a prosecutor, I have no interest and no desire to wrongfully convict anybody. I think that, you know, I think that it is, you know, a criminal to hold people responsible for charges that they don't, that they haven't done.
They've been arrested under the law of probable cause, is what they're being arrested under. The prosecutors don't even see other than it was there. Law enforcement does not have sufficient funding to continue with a complete computer analysis. It's not until after the fact, and that's been done by a nonprofit organization.
From what I and I can't speak to different counties in terms of policy, but in terms of the law of probable cause as it is in California, is that you can only keep someone in custody for 48 hours, and then until charges are filed. And if there isn't charges filed within 48 hours, they must be released. So
they've been charged, and I've got cases to prove it. They're being charged in a big rush. They are being prosecuted. They are sitting there. And the statistics are horrific. People are not paying attention. The news is not letting people know just how bad, how prolific this crime is. But there are records that you can research. This dates back in 2003. The National Association to Protect Children addressed Congress in regards to how prolific this operation is. And yes, under probable cause, people are being arrested, not just a few hundred, but thousands, and then overall, hundreds of thousands. And if
why aren't they going to trial?
Oh, they half of them don't go to trial because they're scared to death. They're copying plea bargains, which I don't agree with. The others can't afford $30,000 or $40,000 to dig their way out. Some have. I mean, I've helped some people, but that's not the point. It shouldn't be happening at all.
I feel like you're very defensive, and I'm agreeing with you. So I'm agreeing with what you're doing.
Oh no, I'm not defensive. I mean, I'm stating fact, trying to be brushed because I know we are on a time constraint.
Can I intervene here for a second?
Of course.
I think we have a little disagreement, perhaps about statistics, but I think there's agreement here, the way I interpret the conversations, in that this is a major problem. Law enforcement doesn't have sufficient resources to properly address the problem.
That is
the public
correct.
Isn't aware of it as much as they should be, and the public needs to be educated and get
correct.
Involved and help clean this stuff up. Are we all in agreement on those points?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yes, I am.
Okay. And what I'd like to do is, caller, could you please, if people want more information about your organization, could you give us the name again and a website address, please?
The website, we have a new one that we're going to be uploading in the next couple of days, is www.angelsagainstchildpredators.com. Spelled as it sounds, there's no spaces.
Okay. And this will be active, you say, in a couple of days?
There's one up now with information, does have some case history and such for contact. It doesn't have the full endorsements. That's just why we've decided to design a new one, just because of the capacity. So many people are endorsing. It costs no one, absolutely nothing, other than 10 seconds of their time. And yes, the mass population needs to be aware that they are being needlessly exposed to charges of possession of child pornography. And yes, those who are sitting in jail that did not solicit it need to be released. It's really simple.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that information. We appreciate your calling in.
Thank you so much.
Okay, have a good evening now.
Bye-bye.
Okay, ladies, that's obviously this woman is very passionate about her cause and her beliefs. What I'd like to do also is we were discussing statistics a moment ago, and when I first heard of the Haley Cummings case, the missing girl in Florida, and we don't know if there's a sexual abuse involved with this or not, we don't know what happened to her for sure at this point, but I remember when I heard that, I think the community she's from is about 5,000 population. I heard there were 44 registered sex offenders within a mile or so of her residence. I thought that was shockingly high. After I talked with Heather, I found out it doesn't necessarily, and those, as Heather pointed out to me, are just the people who have been caught and are in the system.
Mm.
And Heather, you you want to give us some more of those statistics about what a number like that represents and how many are probably out there altogether?
Well, according to our information that we calculated from Department of Justice statistics, basically it looks like about less than 1% of child molesters in the traditional method of a child coming forward and reporting and then law enforcement making an arrest and then going to prosecution and then being convicted, less than 1% of offenders are convicted of child molestation. And if we use child pornography, we have a much better chance of going in and identifying these guys, finding them, and catching them. And because we know that there's a really high correlation between viewing child pornography and actually being a molester, and studies out of federal prison in Butner, North Carolina show that there's almost a one-to-one correlation between viewing child pornography and actually being a hands-on molester. And on average, two studies there showed about 14 to 31 victims each. So if we take the mean victim number, about 22, and 624,000 guys trading child pornography on peer-to-peer networks, we can see that there's about 13.7 million, possibly million victims in the United States. So, you know, we're talking about huge numbers of predators and huge numbers of victims, and very few of them ever get caught. So, as Robin said earlier, these guys are definitely looking for situations where they can get access to kids, and it could be a girlfriend situation, or it could be something like being a pediatrician or being a teacher or a coach or a clergyman or, you know, a camp counselor or a babysitter. There are a lot of different ways that these people kind of camouflage themselves and work in society to try to get access.
Yeah, brother. Robin.
Yeah.
I want to mention, before I forget, that you have a new book titled Predators and Child Molesters, What Every Parent Needs to Know to Keep Kids Safe. And it's a must-have guide for parents, and it's available for pre-order on Amazon.
Am I correct?
Okay.
That is correct.
And how long did it take you to write that book?
It's actually interesting. I was the prosecutor on the Lincoln Middle School, Thomas Beltran, 30-year veteran teacher, and bringing up exactly the point that Heather makes, is that here's someone who had access to children over 30 years, and he, through the course of being an English as a second language teacher, was able to groom both parents and kids into trusting him as they acclimated to the United States. And as I went through that case and I saw I met with so many different parents and also attended town hall meetings at the various schools in Santa Monica and other schools, I found out how little educated, well-to-do people were misinformed in terms of how the criminal justice system works, how a child sexual assault case works, what types of things they needed to do to prevent child sexual assault. And I, at the time, was writing a book called Inside the Life of a Sex Crimes DA, which that book is actually coming out later, and actually the subtitle for that is It Happens Every Day, because as Heather points out, it does, and it happens in large numbers. And I convinced my publishers to do a quick turnaround to get this information out as quick as I possibly could do. The quickest that they would allow a book to get published was within 6 months, which is exactly what I did. And I said, you know, I want to keep it affordable and paperback, and I want to get it to, you know, anyone who calls me up and wants the information and can't afford it, I'll personally send them a copy of the book, because I want, it's really about having good, correct information out there. I mean, that's one of the problems, is when there are these conflicts of statistics, which there are because of how we even define the crime of what child sexual assault is. DOJ categorizes it one way, law enforcement categorizes it as another way, DA's office another way, advocacy groups another way. And because of the different, and while everyone may have good intentions, there's no uniformity in terms of the information out there, and that was what I was trying to fill that void.
Excellent. And hopefully we'll get a lot of people to read that book and start the education process, which apparently, and I know just speaking from my ignorance, is really needed to bring out what the problem is and how we can hopefully deal with it and get it under control. Now, I realize that different states have different laws, and of course there are federal laws. But Robin, what do you think of the laws that we currently have to deal with the child sexual abuse problems? Are they adequate? Are they too weak? Or is it strictly a matter of jurisdiction?
Well, you know, that's a real broad question because there are each jurisdiction has their own laws, and then of course there are some federal laws, and especially when it deals with child pornography. I think that there's definitely changes that can be made, and lots of changes that I would suggest if I were, you know, king of the world and legislature and president, I would make lots and lots of changes. However, there are little nuggets of great laws out there that what's almost worse than not having good laws out there is prosecutors, law enforcement not knowing about them. Here in California, there are ways to get, you know, mandatory life sentences that DAs are simply not trained on how to do, and aren't creative in how they find corroboration or how they go about handling a case, that the law is kind of there and up for grabs for the taking, but sometimes they're ill used.
Wow. Do you think that as public awareness of the problem, the public become more aware, that there will be pressure on the various state legislatures to get tough and to educate the people in the criminal justice system as to how to use the laws?
Well, that's the goal. I mean, that's what Heather and I and a lot of us out there like to do, is the more people, each person that we can educate and infuriate, frankly, hopefully will drive some change. The problem also is, as I said, is awareness. And I think part of the awareness comes from this, you know, parents' denial, because no one wants to think of this as being a reality. And you have parents out there who just kind of, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've volunteered and have given free lectures at schools with all kinds of, you know, offering free food and everything, and you get a school of 500 and you have 12 parents show up. I mean, every parent should want to have good information. I mean, the crimes are not necessarily being perpetuated by, you know, the stranger in the alley with the, you know, with a trench coat on. These are people that we know. These are people that live in our homes. These are people that our kids have access to. And parents, you know, need to get off their butt and be proactive.
Heather, I want to ask you something. I'll get back to the Hannah Mack case for a moment. From what I read at the start here from the newspaper about what this gentleman testified to when he made his plea appearance, is there any way to tell from that limited information whether there should have been warning signs in the home? Should someone have seen this coming?
Well, do you mean the guy who just confessed today that the boyfriend was involved, or the boyfriend?
Well, actually, I was thinking that from what the guy who confessed indicated, it was, well, I guess we're stretching it, giving him the benefit of the doubt that he's telling the truth here. But if what he said is true, that this guy apparently this wasn't the first time he was fooling around with the kids, at least with Hannah. And, you know, if something like that is going on in your home, should other people who live in the home be aware of it? Should there be warning signs somehow? Or are these guys so slick that they're doing this kind of stuff and there's just no way to tell?
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about my area of expertise, which is the child pornography, which is the boyfriend. And
yeah.
then maybe let Robin kind of respond, because I think she has a lot more experience in dealing with a wide variety of predators outside the child pornography realm and child pornography. But I think, you know, the thing about the boyfriend who is in jail right now for child pornography charges, and they're, you know, investigating, according to the prosecutor, they're investigating, you know, if there's more evidence to be able to charge him with, you know, the rape and the murder of Hannah at this time. But currently he's residing in jail for the child pornography charges. Is, you know, I guess the thing is, before, you know, a woman might want to invite a man to come live with her, or while a man is living with her, you know, she might want to check his cell phone or his iPod or his computer and see if there are child pornography images on those items, if she can find them in a cursory search. It might be something that you can do to try to check out before you allow, you know, some man to come live with you and your daughters. That's the only thing that I can offer from a child pornography perspective that might help determine, you know, who might be a predator or a danger to your kids.
Okay, and Robin?
Yeah, I'm happy to weigh in here on that. I think that, you know, Heather and I make a great team, because she truly is the expert when it comes to child pornography and in terms of how that is in itself a warning sign. But the first thing is that what we want to teach our children and what parents need to learn to listen to is this wonderful part of our makeup called our instincts. Our instincts are infallible. I'm not saying that our instincts, that we're always right, but our instincts part are something that we should always be listening to. We too often as parents get an icky feeling about somebody and try to talk ourselves out of that icky feeling because we want to be politically correct, or we want to be nice, or we want to be have nice manners. But the fact of the matter is, someone gives you the heebie-jeebies, that's enough for the protection of our children. You listen to that and you keep that person away. Anybody who wants to, you know, any person who decides that they want to babysit your kid for no money, for no good reason, and they're not a family member, you know, and have no relationship, and you think, God, that's kind of weird that they want to do it. It is. It's weird. People generally don't want to hang out with young kids unless they're getting paid for it or they're related to that person. So things that, you know, that's my first piece of advice, is if you feel it, you're right. And then, of course, there are other things. I mean, people, one other sign is, you know, one of the things that you find out about, that you see in predators out there, and a specific type of predators, is one kind of like Michael Jackson. And that is kind of the person who really hasn't grown up, the person that doesn't perceive themselves as an adult, the person who acts like a kid. A person who, you know, acts like a kid, views themselves as a kid, and tends to form relationships with kids is a danger to your child. I don't care if they're fun and want to play games, but as an adult, if they don't act and know how to act like an adult, they have no business being an authority figure or be around your child. There are hundreds of other signs that I could, you know, say, but the most important one is that, and of course, any parent who lets someone who has, you know, been convicted of any sort of child sexual assault around their child, I mean, there are people, the fact that after the Michael Jackson case, that people would still let people go to Neverland Ranch is beyond me.
Yeah, that is, yes. It's very bizarre and tough to explain. Let me just ask you a question about what's going on with the Hannah Mack thing. Now, this live-in boyfriend hasn't been charged yet based on the other guy's statements in court that the live-in boyfriend was involved and actually orchestrated the murder of the young girl. As part of a plea bargain that this guy entered into to avoid the death penalty, would there normally be some provision in there that if he was caught lying in his statements or something, that would void the deal? Or is he pretty well home free as far as the death penalty goes?
Well, in when we negotiate any sort of leniency from my office and good practices, We are entering this deal on the basis of, you know, these terms, and that including that the facts that you have said check out and are accurate, and if that works out not to be the case, then the deal is withdrawn. I don't see why a perpetrator gets the benefit of a bargain if the benefit of the bargain is no longer existing. But it really depends on the exact statements, the exact deal that was struck between the individual agency. But that's, you know, there's pleas all the time that are taken that saying, you know, we're going to give you this deal based on what we believe your sentence to be. I mean, excuse me, what we believe your prior criminal record to be. And if your record comes back that's different than what we believe it to be, then we have the right to withdraw. Now, that the right to withdraw, you have to remember, is it doesn't mean that now that means that we get to change the conviction and the plea gets to stand. What it means is that the whole thing gets to get unraveled, and the whole case gets to start anew. That means that the defendant still has a right to a trial, and then the prosecution still needs to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. So, you know, sometimes we have to be careful of why things don't get necessarily unraveled, because, you know, time has passed, witness availability, what's the state of the case, and so forth.
So there's a lot of things to consider then.
Absolutely.
As to what you're going to do or what should be done.
Correct.
Heather, obviously, I think we're all in agreement that we need to do something here. Now, your organization, do you want to get into a little more detail about what you do, give out some information where people can learn more about your organization, and perhaps some ideas of what we can do to help?
Okay. The Innocent Justice Foundation basically is founded on the knowledge that law enforcement teams are drowning right now in the United States from the overwhelming number of cases of child pornography, possession, distribution, and production. And because they've identified about 624,000 individual IP addresses that are trading child pornography in the United States on peer-to-peer networks, and they only have about, according to USA Today and the Wyoming Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force numbers, they only have resources to go after about 1% of those guys. Basically, what we're doing is trying to enable them to be able to go after 100% of child pornography perpetrators. And one of the other things that we do that's vital to this work is the education of the public about what child pornography really is, because I think we all have misconceptions before we really understand what it is, that it could be baby in the bathtub stuff, or it could be kids running around on the beach. And it's not that at all. Basically, these are pictures. Most of the pictures involve children being raped. And 20% of the collections, according to a government study that's posted on NCMEC's website, the National Center for Missing, Exploited, and Children, show that 21% of these pictures involve infliction of pain on the child, so torture. So what we do is we educate people that this is really serious stuff. And there's very, very few pictures out there, collections that limit themselves to just nude or semi-nude photos. So, and we also educate. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Heather, you bring up a great point. I want to throw this out just as you're saying in terms of dangerous stuff. What people don't realize with child pornography is that the picture of the person is a piece of evidence of somebody who's been victimized, and that person in that picture is a victim of a sex crime. So it's not just child pornography as its own separate crime. It's, you know, the only reason why we can't also prosecute for the actual exploitation and the abuse and the crime that's occurred is because a lot of the people in the pictures we can't identify.
Absolutely. And, you know, they are working on trying to identify more of the children. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children has a child victim identification program. It's called CVIP. And they're working really hard to try to identify these kids and rescue them, because so many of them are American kids. And although it does involve kids, you know, all over the world, we are the number one producer and consumer of child pornography in the world. And so by necessity, the victims are located here in the United States. And it is really vital that we take those crime scene photos and we try to identify the kids and go out and get them. So, you know, child pornography is also that, you know, it's a crime to produce it. Obviously, it shows the molestation of a child. And so that's a no-brainer when we go to charge. But the reason why it's also so serious, and I mentioned this before, possession is really, really serious crime. And because it's a felony in most states, not California. Well, California is a felony, but it's also still a misdemeanor. But in most states, it's a felony. It's a very, very serious crime. And I guess kind of to the point of our caller who called in earlier, I would be really surprised if someone pre-bargained and said, yes, I'm going to take a plea on child pornography possession if they really didn't, you know, have it on their computer, because most states will make you register as a sex offender for the rest of your life if you're caught. It's a very, very serious crime.
What types of things can the public do to help? Is it strictly a matter of donating money or donating time, or can we do a variety of things to help out trying to get to the bottom of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple things that people can do. You can take a look at our website and look at the teams that are making requests for items, and we'll be updating that. We're starting to get 3 to 4 requests from law enforcement teams every week. So, you know, there are a lot of teams out there that are desperate for equipment to rescue kids and do their jobs, and they're from every state in the union that they're overwhelmed law enforcement teams. So we provide that vehicle for the public to be able to support their local law enforcement teams by donating directly. They get a charitable tax deduction, and the teams actually get the equipment that they need that aren't covered by their budgets. One of the other things that people can do, you know, is talk about this a little bit more, because as Robin mentioned earlier, people don't want to think that this is happening. And I think we really need to get a conversation going in the United States where people understand that this is very widespread and it's happening in our neighborhoods and in our homes. And I think the third thing that people can do is to report child pornography when they find it. And I think that's really key, because there are a lot of people who find child pornography who don't necessarily think that it is something that is, they may think it's terrible and it's horrible, but they don't want that person's, you know, that they found the child pornography, they don't want that person maybe to go to jail. Or maybe they think if they just don't hang around that person anymore, everything is cool. Those children in the pictures, maybe they're in Thailand or Russia or something like that. But I really want to point out, as Robin said, that these are crime scene photos of children. And we need to get them to law enforcement so that law enforcement can identify these kids and go and rescue them. So there are a lot of different reasons to report child pornography, but that's a really big one, is that there are children who are locked in pictures in that hard drive who need to be rescued. And if those pictures don't get to law enforcement, those children may never have a chance to get out of the hellish nightmare that they live in, because they're local kids. They're kids local. They're rural kids. They're urban kids. They're suburban kids. They're everywhere in the United States.
So if someone finds evidence in their home that someone who shares that home, be it a son or a brother or a husband, living boyfriend, what have you, is involved with child porn, just confronting them and saying, hey, do you think you got a problem, that really isn't sufficient. It needs to be go beyond that as far as reporting.
Well, and I really would advise not confronting the person. It's like a warning flag for them to go and delete the evidence and try to destroy the evidence. I think, you know, the most important thing is, it's a big mistake, because first of all, let's talk a little bit about predators. I mean, their job is to really make sure that people believe them and that they look and blend into society, and they're expert pathological liars. So the first thing you do when you confront a pedophile is he's going to have an explanation for everything, absolutely everything, and it's going to be pretty smooth, and you're going to believe it most of the time. And what you have to do is not listen to the words. You have to look at the evidence. The evidence is, if someone is viewing child pornography, then the real truth about it is they're using it to achieve sexual gratification. They look at pictures of children being raped and tortured, and that's how they achieve their sexual gratification. There's no way to fix that. There's no way to change that. That is a fact. You have to face reality that that person is very sick. That person is looking for opportunities to act out on their fantasies, and you need to get yourself to safety immediately. If you have children in the house, you need to get them to safety immediately, whatever that means. If it means changing the locks on the house, if it means leaving the house with your children, taking that evidence to your, you know, calling 911 or taking that evidence to your local Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, it is of the highest priority that this is not something that is just so that you could confront someone with. This is finding someone who, you know, could take your life. I mean, it, ultimately, in the end, I don't want to say that all of them would do that. I don't want to be all, you know, but I want people to take this seriously. You know, confronting, sometimes it happens that people do confront and they end up disappearing. So I think the most important thing is get yourself to safety and get the evidence to the police.
Robin, let me ask you this. I don't know how it applies to your particular jurisdiction, but I've heard people from other areas complain about some of the sentencing for these child abusers, child molesters. And, for example, in some areas there's a lot of emphasis on treatment, and these people are released to the community, maybe on probation, maybe after serving a relatively short sentence. And they have to go to counseling and so on and so forth. And I guess my question is, a lot of the people I talk to don't seem to think that's really working. Do you know, do these counseling sessions and so forth, are they really kind of a cure-all, or is it hit and miss, or what?
Well, you know, there's a whole bunch of perspectives. You know, I agree in mandatory sentences and clearly as long as sentences as possible. But there's a corollary here that a lot of people who do have gripes with how people are sentenced that don't really get another part of the system sometimes. And that is the reality of the fact that if a defendant who chooses to go to trial and they are acquitted, then they get nothing. And even worse than getting nothing, you're sending a person back into the community saying, you just got away with it. And they do it, you know, we know they do it again. So sometimes there are cases where, you know, even myself, where I, you know, have less than stellar evidence. And just the reality is that with child sexual assault cases, we many times don't have very good evidence because sex crimes are done, you know, sex by its nature is done in privacy. And as Heather aptly points out, that these are pathological liars who have spent their life figuring out how to hide and slither into society and do a good job covering up. So sometimes, while, you know, the quality of the counseling is kind of a little, in my mind, many times is neither here nor there. It's the quality of the conviction that I like. That, you know, many times if you can get someone convicted and get them on, you know, have a convicted as a sex offender and therefore have to register as a sex offender, then we have a chance of having a slippery slope, and then we have corroboration for, unfortunately, it happens this way, but for the next time the person does it, if the person's a true pedophile or the person is a danger to the community, they will do it again, and then the next victim there in line will not have to have a case where there's less than stellar evidence. They'll be a registered sex offender with a prior conviction, and then the jury does convict on those, and then the person goes away forever. So while, and I hate to say that we have to, you know, sacrifice victims for that to happen, but if the choice is an acquittal, you know, or nothing versus a conviction with a registration, while the counseling may do nothing at all, the conviction will have, you know, carry its weight in gold later on.
Yeah, so we're building a history rather than taking a chance on weak evidence of getting to nothing.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's a cost-benefit analysis that we do all the time in all kinds of deals, right?
Right, absolutely. Let me ask both of you this. I was listening to another program a week or so ago, and there was It was regarding actually Kaylee Anthony and the Haley Cummings cases. But a caller, and I believe he was from Canada, said that they are doing something in Canada using, I guess, the nearest I could say was like a GPS situation, inserting chips in children. And if they're missing and they have this chip, they could be tracked immediately and their location identified. Have you heard anything that that type of technology is out there or available?
Robin?
Okay. Well, I mean, I've heard that there's been a lot of talk about that technology for many, many years, and there's, you know, big proponents of that kind of technology, and then, of course, there are parents who have, you know, opponents of that technology as well. I mean, the technology exists. There's no doubt about it. I mean, we use it in dogs already in terms of tracking devices and knowing where they are and being able to scan them and know, you know, who the parents are or the owners are in the case of an animal. And it, that kind of technology exists. The question is first of all, you know, are parents who won't show up to a lecture on how to protect their kids inclined to let them go through a surgical process to insert some sort of device that, you know, has the ability to track where they are? And, you know, I think you'd be surprised if, you know, I'd say, you know, darn, why not, you know, put those devices in all three of my kids and feel that way, feel like that's a cost-benefit analysis. But I don't see a lot of parents in reality being comfortable doing that, you know, not to mention all of the privacy issues and all the, you know, the negative effects that have to be considered as well.
Well, it certainly is something you couldn't mandate, I don't think. I mean, people are not going to sit still, you know, the Big Brother thing. But I suppose on a voluntary basis, if the parent or family is paying out of their pocket and there's not public funding involved, I guess if it really works, you know, and it's up to the individuals, it sounds like something. I mean, look at, you know, Haley Cummings and Kaylee and all that kind of stuff. You wonder if you had that ability in those cases and others like them. I mean, there's how many thousands of children missing?
Well, the one thing that you need to think about, though, and one of the things, those types of products, that's an after-the-fact product. Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, that's a product that's used, you know, to find someone that's already missing. It doesn't prevent the missing. It doesn't prevent the crime. And so I worry a bit about parents feeling false sense of security. Oh, my kid's chipped. Well, no, you still need to teach your kids safety skills. You still need to educate them. You still need to be aware of who's around. You still need to listen to your instincts. You still need to watch for red flags. And so anything that, you know, that is, you know, if you're using that kind of device, it's a problem. It's
mm-hmm.
a crime already.
Well,
yes.
And I, you know, I want to interject that, you know, the vast majority of kids that are sexually assaulted are not kidnapped. I mean, looking at the numbers of, you know, child molesters who are molesting kids, they're in the circle of trust. They're 96%. So you could be tracking your child and know your child is at school or know your child is at church, and that child is being molested. That doesn't stop the child from being molested. And again, I agree, but I also want to bring up the point that if there's technology that exists for you to track your child, then the pedophiles can hack into it and also track your child.
Oh, man. There's always a downside, it seems like, to everything. I mean, you know, things that sound good when you analyze them, as Robin was saying, that you find that it may not be quite as good as it first appears.
No, I mean, wouldn't that be great for them? Aren't they rooting for us to use this technology? Oh, my God, then they can identify kids all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And use it as a means to groom them because they now know who they are and where they're from and all those other things.
Yeah,
true.
Let me ask a quick question that I've been wondering about. I don't know if there are statistics on this or not, but it seems to me, for the most part, when you get some of these people who are molesting infants, I mean, 18 months old and this kind of thing. Now, in most cases, these are, you know, these are not the abductions, as you just said, Heather. These are family members, family friends, people who have access to these kids. And it I don't know, it's very difficult for me to think of what would, You know, I mean, I could understand, I shouldn't say understand, I could more understand if you're talking about the 16 or 15-year-old girl, for example, who looks 21 and that type of thing, of the attraction. But, you know, a baby, I mean, that just blows my mind. I can't make sense to it. Can you help me there?
Well, no, I mean, I can't go there either, Denny. I don't really understand what would make a person, you know, be attracted to a prepubescent child in any way, shape, or form. And even to hurt a baby, that, you know, to see a baby screaming or crying, that actually causes pleasure, you know, in pain and trying to get away. Again, I don't understand how that would cause pleasure for someone. And, you know, I think the case of Chester Stiles, who just yesterday, I believe, was convicted, he raped a 2-year-old little girl and videotaped it, and he raped her every way that a person could rape a child. And, you know, he was just convicted on, I believe, 22 felony counts and will go to jail for multiple life sentences. But I don't, you know, I wish our psychologist who is on our board who treats sex offenders were here to talk, to speak to that. I mean, I think these guys try to, they have really distorted thought patterns, obviously. I mean, what do you think, Robin? Do you have a perspective?
No, I mean, I agree. I mean, I think that's kind of part of the problem is that we try to make sense of it. And the fact of the matter is that it's sick. It's sick. These are people who have sicknesses, and there are different, you know, the law treats, you know, sexual assault, and many, they divide it by the age of the victim and sometimes also compare the age difference between the perpetrator and the victim, and rightfully so. I mean, there are people who are molesting babies and raping babies and children should be treated even, you know, harsher, you know, and the law recognizes that, you know, kids who are 15 and 16 are sexually and developmentally curious and, you know, may engage in relationships with people who are, you know, older. And it's different to have a 15-year-old having sex with a 19-year-old versus 15-year-old having sex with an 80-year-old. I mean, it's a different situation. It's also different having, you know, a 10-year-old with a, you know, a 19-year-old or whatever. We have to look at it in perspective and not in a vacuum.
And certainly, I know we started out with Hannah Mack, and as we said, that's the extreme, you know, the murder. But I wonder how many children who are victims of especially ongoing abuse and are not killed. I mean, the emotional problems they must experience down the road, so their lives can be, even though they're not physically killed, their lives, in a lot of cases, I suppose, are ruined anyway.
I mean, they certainly affect people, and that's the argument, that, you know, whether, it, you know, they're ruined or they turn it into opportunities, you know, it depends on the individual person. I mean, we know that, you know, drug use and abuse, alcohol use and abuse, suicide attempts, all, you know, the inability to maintain healthy, normal relationships, all of those factors are in play. And as prosecutors, vehemently argue for, you know, restitution to last for victims to be able to have therapy for the rest of their life, because there's no way to assess what the effect is going to be today, you know, on a 10-year-old in 20 years.
You know, I don't know where the time went to. Well, I do. It flew. But in the last little bit we've got left, starting with Robin. Robin, I'd like you to, again, tell us about your book, title of the book, and any ordering information, and then we'll give Heather a chance to close.
Thank you. And all of my books can be found on robinsax.com, and that's RobinSax.com. The first one being released is Child Molesters and Predators, and that comes out in April. And I basically go through answering parents' 100 most asked questions.
Okay, and best of luck with that book, and I'm going to certainly be getting a copy. And thank you very much for being on with us tonight. You've been an absolutely great guest.
Thank you. No, and my pleasure, and it's been wonderful, and any time I can be with Heather, who's amazing, it's always an honor.
Okay. Thanks, Robin.
I feel the same about Robin.
Heather, would you give us your website again and the idea of possibly getting to talk with your psychologist at some point in the future? If you could arrange that, I'm sure that would be a valuable program.
Yeah, I'll be happy. I know a couple of psychologists who do sex offender treatment and have a little bit better insight. But if you want to know more about our work, we're at www.innocentjustice.org. And again, you know, we've got law enforcement teams on there. We could use your help to support any of your local teams and, you know, start talking about the problem more. Thank you so much, Denny, for having us on to talk about this, to really get the word out to people.
Well, thank you, and I'm sure we'll do something again. If I can help in any other way that you can think of, please don't hesitate to contact me.
Awesome. Have a great night.
Thanks, Heather. You too. And folks, we're out of time, and we just got the live stream cut off. I want to thank everybody for listening, and hopefully it's helped some to make us a little more aware of what's going on out there. And again, my special thanks to the people from Justice Interrupted and Juror 13. I see a lot of them in the chat room, and I really appreciate your listening in. Okay, have a great night, folks. Bye-bye.